the whole first 2 minutes of every podcast sound that starts with us saying you're recording and you're recording.
I know.
And I can see you're recording.
Absolute paranoia that one of these days.
Oh, I know.
We are going to do it, and I'm going to just forget to hit the record button. It hasn't happened yet, but
what do you record your backups to? Do you record it to a separate?
You see my screen?
Hang on, you're behind Audacity at the minute. Oh. Yep. All right. You got a Zoom? Yep.
Okay. Zoom H1.
Yep. Same as me.
Yeah. Trusty yep. Zoom H1.
Classic.
I would buy more of them if they would drop in value ever. But
oh, they just don't, though, do they? Even the second-hand ones are almost new price.
Even the old version of the H1 isn't much cheaper than just buying a brand-new version of it. Is it the H1N? Yeah. I can't remember.
Yeah. H1N, yeah. I don't know what the difference is. I think mine's the old original version.
Yeah, mine is as well. But
you got the swanky white one.
I've got a white one for some reason. Don't know why. Yeah. But they're great little recorders, and even using it without a lav mic and just the inbuilt little mics in it are fantastic little stereo pair mics. You know it.
Yeah, superb.
Just a quick if you're at a live concert or like you're seeing a friend's band play or something like that, and they want just a quick recording mocked up of their band.
Yeah,
I've used it for that a few times, right. And the quality's amazing for what it is. You know,
whenever I try to do voice recording on it, I get quite a lot of handling noise off it. So you need to be quite careful with how you hold it.
But. Yeah, although not as bad as the GoPro handling noise, which you might as well be hitting it with a hammer while holding it.
Yes, I've had a bit of feedback on my action camera handling skills. We'll come back to that maybe later on. But
all right. Well, I tell you what. Let's quickly run the credits, and then we'll come back. We'll come straight back to that. Welcome back to the Measuring Up podcast, the UK's first and possibly favourite commercial joinery podcast. I'm Andy McClellan, and I run the Gosforth Handyman YouTube channel and a whole bunch of other YouTube channels that I seem to be collecting.
I'm Peter Millard, as well as running a virtual 10-minute workshop and possibly something else as well on YouTube. I also run a small but far from perfectly formed carpentry and cabinet making business in the garden spot of West London. Now, every couple of weeks we get together in our little sound booths, and due to the wonderful of the internet, we talk about the topics of the day, whatever takes our fancy or whatever's been suggested by you, our lovely, lovely listeners. But before we get into any of that, Andy Mac, welcome back. How have you been?
I've been very well, but actually, today I've got a sore jaw.
A sore jaw?
So I thought I would just chuck that out there, because I know we always say that we're always well, but I've got this weird jaw issue where it hurts to open my mouth. It feels like I can only open my mouth like a little bit, and I'm getting this like pain in the top of my jaw. And it's
bizarre.
It's a very weird thing. I don't know if it's connected with some sort of ear. Well, I don't really have earache. I don't have toothache.
Mrs. Mac been sort of elbowing you in the jaw overnight?
It feels like I've been punched in the jaw. That's kind of what. Well, no, it doesn't, because it only hurts when I try and open my mouth.
Right.
And
so you're talking very very close lipped today, then?
Yeah. Well, if you're notice that I am kind of talking like this, it's because I can kind of open it to
How strange. About
like an inch or something, and then anything past that, it's like it really feels like it's stretching the jaw muscles. It's just
how weird. It's age, mate. It's age.
Mid forties. Yeah.
Yes, basically
falling to pieces.
welcome to my life. Yes, all the things that were working perfectly well before are suddenly stopped working or are starting to hurt when they work.
Just such random things. It's just like I woke up a couple of months ago, and this giant knobble had appeared on my wrist. Like, just this kind of, I don't know if you can see it or not.
Oh, wow, that's, god damn, wow. I'm pleased that nobody else can see that, gee.
It's like, huge. What's it called? Oh, I forgot what it's called. A ganglion cyst. And it doesn't bother us, but literally I was sitting watching telly one day, I looked down on my wrist and it was like, what the hell is that on my wrist?
Was it moving? Some kind of aliens?
Yeah, is it something like growing under the skin? And looked it up, and it's just a random thing that happens in later life. Is
later
that
life. Wow.
Bits of your bone start sticking out through your skin for no reason whatsoever.
And it's perfectly natural, yeah.
Yeah, so anyway, So, yeah, you were saying I watched your Venice video, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. It was very interesting. Yeah. Congratulations on And welcome to the world of second channels.
Second channels, yeah, that's a sobering thing. We're not going to talk too much about YouTube because the last couple of shows were a bit YouTube heavy, so we won't go into it in too much detail today. But I did start a second channel, and almost nobody noticed. I'd been away to Venice for a couple of weeks with Mrs. 10 Minutes, and while we were there, I didn't want to make it a photo and video trip, but at the same time, I didn't want to waste the opportunity. So there's a few things there that I wanted to shoot some slightly more serious video on. So more serious than just using my phone or whatever. So I took the big camera and a few other bits and pieces. And one of the things that I used was, I got a little, we talked about it, I think last week or the week before, a little GoPro alike sort of action camera. And that's perfect for just, you can just shove it in your pocket. It's relatively cheap and cheerful. Shoots 4K 30p video, and the sound's not bad on it as long as you're holding it fairly close to. I was really happy with it. What I do is I don't like to have the image stabilization switched on in it, because for lots of complex technical reasons, and there may well be a video out on my second channel about this in future, the lens correction that you get, so you're to avoid that super wide sort of fisheye look, you can't apply that lens correction at the same time as have image stabilization on. So I shot the video, and I'm perfectly comfortable with a certain amount of wobbliness and shake. And I had a lot of negative comments about the hand holding of the camera ness. You ought to get a gimbal. I've got a gimbal. It just doesn't fit this camera. Also, I was traveling light and not trying to turn this into a photographic expedition. So the video's out there. And I was perhaps slightly cynically trying to catch a little bit of the wave, if you'll forgive the pun, of interest in Venice at the time, because obviously Venice has had some bad floods recently. And before I posted that video, the first video on the channel, there's a little mini documentary, Will Venice Survive? And that's, when I put mine out, that had like 150,000 views or something. So, that looks interesting. Okay. Put mine out. Mine's had about 1,500 views since then. And this other one has had 1.2 million or something. And lots of people have said, oh, I watched yours, and then this other one was recommended afterwards. It was really interesting. I thought, crikey, you know, a bit of quid pro quo would be nice. You know, people who watch that one recommend mine, maybe. But as always,
1,500 views is amazing for a brand new channel, mind.
That's, for a first channel, obviously we're not starting completely afresh. I've cross promoted it with on the main channel, and I've picked up a lot of my current subscribers have come across as well. So mm-hmm. I took 4 months, I think, to get 1,000 subscribers on the 10-Minute Workshop channel. And admittedly, it was very quick, but it did take more than 24 hours to get that in on the second channel. But it happened very quickly.
You've ticked the first box for monetization, then?
The first box, but not a long way off the second, unfortunately.
Yeah, the second one takes a little while.
The 4,000 hours, yeah. We chatted a little bit about this privately as well, but it really is kind of back to basics, starting obviously not quite afresh, but with a brand new channel with, you know, one video, one trailer, no views and no subscribers. It's not sobering exactly, but it takes you back, doesn't it?
It does.
When you put stuff out there and nothing happens.
But one of the things that's kind of nice about it is that you know what to do now. So you're not making all the mistakes that we would have made when we're first starting out on YouTube, you know.
Absolutely.
And that's kind of, and typically, I think it can result in that channel, doing pretty well, because you're doing everything right from the ground up. And when you've got the experience of, you know, 200 or 300 videos behind you, that makes a massive difference.
It does. And not just knowing what to do, you know, knowing how to speak to a camera and all that sort of stuff helps. Because obviously, you know, right at the very start, you're just making it up as you go along, as much as we are now. But yeah, you know, we've got a bit more experience of it, and we sort of know what we're doing, at least.
Sort of,
yeah.
I feel like I'm getting there slowly. I mean, I'm in this, I can't remember if I mentioned it last time, but I'm in this living hell at the minute of updating thumbnails, titles and descriptions
yeah.
all of my videos, so 250-odd videos on my channel, and I'm literally going through, mainly because of all this copper FTC malarkey that's going on.
Yeah.
And I think the whole FTC thing is just the tip of the iceberg, and YouTube's been a free-for-all for a long time, and there's always been certain little things that have, like, niggled at the back of my mind in terms of, you know, advertising standards and just freely mentioning products without necessarily mentioning that it's sponsorship or affiliate. Not on our channels, but I've seen this a lot on other channels. So I'm just tidying up things like affiliate links and making sure that it's obvious that it's an affiliate link before someone clicks on it. So rather than before, I think I had it buried down in the text somewhere that it was an affiliate link, and now I'm just trying to make it a bit more clear what it is. And also singing the praises of affiliate links, because I think they're the best way of funding this sort of content. Yeah. Because,
however, they are one of the things that could go away. Like
exactly.
That.
Exactly.
If YouTube decided to, it's still I still find it quite remarkable that YouTube allow affiliate links at all.
I do.
Try putting a video on any one of Amazon's services and having an affiliate link to somebody else.
Yeah, exactly.
you won't get far. Yeah.
So I think it's only a matter of time before a lot of this stuff gets clamped down on. And while I'm going in editing the descriptions and stuff, I figured, well, while I'm at it, I might as well just quickly tweak the thumbnails and. And on it takes forever. And, you know, one video will take maybe 15, 20 minutes if you include the time to make the new thumbnail and stuff. So multiply that across 250-odd videos. And the most I can do is about 25 a day. And anything more than that, I start going insane. And
yeah, I bet. Do you don't bake your thumbnail into the start of the video then?
No, I don't. No. Okay. And plus, my thumbnail has kind of evolved over time. I've pretty much settled on the design that I've got now, and I'm fairly happy with it. I tried lots of different things for thumbnails, and you know, some of them made a difference, some of them didn't really make any difference at all, and so now I've just kind of settled on this one design, and I'm using that on everything just to make it all look vaguely the same, so it's obvious that people are going to the same channel. Just think of daft things as well, like end screens and cards on videos and stuff like that, and daft thing, we've never really talked about it on the podcast. I don't drink anymore, and I haven't drank now for best part of 14 months or something. But I had cards popping up on my videos saying "Buy me a pint" as part of the Patreon promotion.
Yeah. I forgot about that. Yeah, obviously you meant milk.
A pint of milk, exactly. So my Patreon thing's popping up with. Was popping up with a thing on video saying "buy me a pint," and that just completely irrelevant.
Of course,
all of that, and it's a living hell updating this stuff. But as I say, I do think it's only a matter of time before a lot of these things start to get clamped down on, and we'll maybe talk about the bugginess of Studio Beta. We'll save it for next week's show, the Patreon one.
Yeah, we'll talk a little bit about that later. One thing I did learn very quickly about the copper thing, a lot of the smaller YouTubers, like my second channel, I had a comment from a couple of people saying, oh, you know, the not economically viable wording could mean that YouTube will close down any channels that are too small to be worth bothering with. I don't think that's in their interest, to be honest, to do that, because all channels start small. The idea is that they hope that they grow into something worthwhile. They're all worthwhile into something bigger. But the wording, one of the things I learned just looking into this stuff, that wording has been in the UK terms and conditions for quite a long time.
Really?
It's only been updated. Yeah, it's only been updated in the American T's and C's recently, which is how everybody's started to get themselves in a bit of a twist about it. So
I always assumed that YouTube could shut down any channel whenever they wanted anyway, whether it's commercially viable or not.
Yeah, I think it's just another one of those things that they could use to close you down if you start breaching their other rules or guidelines. It's, you're just not commercially viable. You know.
Gone.
End of kind of thing. Yeah. But yes, the actual wording has been around in the UK T's and C's for a while, apparently.
Interesting.
But it's only the US versions that have been that's been updated, which is what all the furore is about, amongst other things as well, of course. But yes, if they haven't closed us down yet, then I suspect...
we're hanging on in there.
There's no guarantee, of course, but yeah, we're hanging in for now. Yeah.
Well, as I say, I enjoyed the Venice video. I thought that was very interesting. I don't know anything about Venice, really, and other than the fact that there's a lot of water.
Yes.
And I thought it was fascinating, you know, little things like the whole... the canals being lined with white stone so you don't accidentally fall in the canal.
That's right.
I was quite impressed with how clean the water is.
Yes, it is very. I had a lovely message on a lovely comment in that video. My channel, the new channel, is called A Maker's Eye, by the way. Go and check it out. It's the idea is that as makers, as people who make stuff, we tend to look at things with a slightly different, you know, different viewpoint to everybody else. So this is my take on various other things. Lots of people sent me, there's a video clip doing the rounds on Twitter and everywhere else of somebody with a selfie stick walking off the, obviously going through a flood, and he just walks off the edge of the pavement effectively into the canal, and lots and lots and lots of people, I have to say, it popped up in my Twitter feed from somebody else just retweeting it, and it did make me laugh out loud first time I saw it, and then you watch it again and it's very clearly a setup.
it's staged
because the, you know, first of all, the guy's wearing a, you know, bright red Santa hat and coat.
Right.
So why is he doing that in Venice? He's got the selfie stick held right out in front of him, and he's walking very purposely towards the edge of the canal. And as he steps off, there's no attempt to sort of save himself or anything. It's one of those cartoon, you know, you're still like, you know, Wile E. Coyote stepping off the edge of a cliff. There's that sort of just straight in. Sort of thing.
Okay.
So there's no attempt to save himself. And then when you look at it again, to start with, I thought he was wearing leggings under his Santa outfit, but it's actually a wetsuit. So, you know, that's probably the giveaway.
Right.
But yeah, anyway, the water is remarkably clear. One of the things that we found, well, obviously there's been very high tides in Venice and massive flooding, much, much higher than everybody was expecting, and it has caused an awful lot of damage and obviously disruption to a lot of homes and businesses. But one of the things we found was that the water is, because it is basically seawater that comes in, but of course, inevitably, there's going to be some sort of sewage mixed in there as well, because, you know, it's got to come in somewhere. And I did have a lovely comment from somebody in that video to say that it was really nice to see that little bit of Venice, because it turns out that this guy's father grew up on the street where the apartment was that that we stay in while we're there. But he said that every year it's really funny watching all these tourists sort of, you know, wade through St. Mark's Square, because it is, you know, there's a lot of seawater and there is a lot of sort of sewage and muck and nastiness mixed in with there. You don't actually see it because it's, you know, liquid, but it's not the sort of thing you'd want to be sort of splashing about in.
I've never seen those disposable welly things that you were wearing over your shoes.
Yeah, they were fascinating. Little disposable, reusable, temporary galosha type things. We paid whatever it was, 10 euros a pair for them. I mean, there are guys in Venice, hawkers, who just appear. As it's getting towards dusk, they just appear with, you know, these little kids' toys that you throw up in the air, and they light up as they go in,
and as they come down,
they light and they float or whatever.
Yeah.
As soon as it starts to rain, they've got sort of, you know, pack-a-max and ponchos and everything else, and as soon as it starts to flood, they magically appear with these sort of temporary galoshes. So literally, we were going out one morning, the morning of the first, before the bad flood. It had been high tide, and we didn't know how deep it was. So we're going out, and we got to the end of our little road over the bridge, and it was sort of ankle deep. And literally, these two guys, I don't know where they came from, they just sort of appeared with these, you know, bags of galoshes. We started off at 15 euros a pair and got them down to 10.
Yeah.
And you can buy them from the kiosk around the corner for 8, but, you know, you've got to wade through ankle deep water to get to this. So, they were extremely effective, I've got to say. Obviously, I got a pair and Linda got a pair. Linda's came with extra rubber bands. These are like temporary Wellington, so they're robust plastic with a semi-solid sole to them, all sealed up, with the elasticated top to them, so that sort of grips around your calf. But what happens is that as you walk in them, because there's not a left or a right, and they're not, you know, great in terms of sizes, they just fall down. So what Linda's came with is an extra pair of rubber bands, and you put those around the ankle to keep it sort of more supported. Mine didn't have those.
Right.
And oddly enough, I couldn't get a refund because the guy just disappeared.
Yeah.
So mine was sort of slowly falling down all the time. So I had to keep hitching them up, because of course if they go too far, then you end up walking on the heel, and if you walk on the heel, then you're going to wear that through in 20 seconds flat, at which point the temporary Wellingtons become temporary buckets.
Yeah, they're gone.
Yeah, and they fill up slowly with water and mud.
I've never seen them before. Never seen them.
Well, this was amazing. The first time that we'd actually experienced the high tide there. The first time that we'd been before around this time. But it had either happened at night or it happened just before we arrived. And we've seen all the boards out. They have boards out that are, you know, temporary pavements, if you like, that gets everything up a couple of feet off the floor.
I thought that was genius, by the way. It's like, what a great solution.
yeah. What we want to know, and we've never found this out, is where do they come from? And who puts them out?
Yeah.
Is there a crack team of board putter-outers who go and do this when the bad tide's coming? Is it a local thing? Do they just got to go and do the locals put them out themselves? Because they're always sort of around at the flood time. But yeah, fascinating. Anyway, yes, the temporary wellies worked very well. And it was a very interesting few days. It was very wet while we were there in terms of weather, so that disrupted things a little bit.
Here's a question that you might know the answer to, or failing that, a bricklayer might know the answer to. Ah. But obviously, buildings are built on engineering bricks tend to be on the first mm-hmm. few courses and stuff, and presumably that's partly for frost protection and things
like that,
because obviously normal bricks, when they've become saturated with water, and then that water freezes, it can blow the fronts off the bricks and things. And I think my understanding is that engineering bricks are less susceptible to that sort of thing. But in Venice, since it's salt water that's saturating the bricks, does that mean that they're less susceptible to freezing?
That's a very good question.
And therefore you wouldn't get frost damage on bricks because of the salt, because presumably over the years the bricks would be absolutely laden with salt in them from all the seawater that's gone in and out and in and out all over the years. And does that mean they don't need to bother with engineering bricks?
There's a question. Yes, I don't know. Judging by the state of some of the bricks that we've seen, they're definitely not engineering bricks.
Yes.
Some of the brickwork was falling apart, literally. It was very, very badly damaged. But I don't know. It's certainly not it's you're probably right in the fact that it's salt water. It certainly shouldn't be freezing, and they very rarely get snow for obvious reasons. I don't know. Short answer, but yeah, fascinating.
Well, there you go. If our hive mind can answer that one, that would be...
Perhaps they can. Perhaps they can. Talking to the hive mind, we've had some great follow-up, haven't we?
We certainly have.
We got a quick one from Glenn. Glenn contacted us a couple of weeks ago about the Dan Pattinson multi-purpose table. I did actually find a link online to that eventually, and we'll put it in the show notes. But Glenn has popped up to say thanks so much for the mention on the show. It made his day. It's our pleasure. Thanks so much for getting in touch with us. He's actually sent us a link to the YouTube channel, which has the Dan Pattinson multi-purpose table. So we'll put that link in the show notes to this show. Glenn goes on to say, with regards to the replacement top, he bought an MFT top for £20 off eBay, but the cheapest he can find now is 38, which is kind of what I found as well. So yeah, no bargain basement link to the £20 top, unfortunately. But the Dan Pattinson table looks interesting. Have you seen it, Andy?
I haven't. No.
No. Okay. Well, we'll leave it until you've had a look at that before we have a chat about it. But it's a tabletop with four legs on it, and the whole thing is constructed so that the legs they don't fold, they remove and sit inside the tabletop for transportation. It's quite a clever system.
But it's kind of like an MFT type top, though, presumably.
It's an MFT, it's a holy top, top with holes in it.
I will check it out.
Yeah. It's one of something that he's made, and he sells plans for it. It's not a commercial product.
Interesting. No, I will check it out.
Thanks to Glenn for getting in touch. You can get in touch with the show Email is almost certainly the simplest way. So contact@measuringuppodcast.com will always find us, or use the contact form at measuringuppodcast.com. Thanks for getting in touch, Glenn.
Indeedy. And we've got a note from Steve saying, "Hi, Andy and Peter. I wonder if both of you have any opinions or advice to offer about being a small maker who wants not to start a full small business, but just wants to make a bit of pocket money on the side and to make make bits and pieces." And he's basically thinking of one-off pieces that he could sell as commissions, but he doesn't want to go down the route of setting up as a sole trader or a limited company or anything like that.
Yeah.
And he's gone on to say, "I understand there are things like Facebook, Etsy, and I believe a new one called YouMonday in the UK. And I'm wondering if you have come across people using any of these outlets that had an opinion." The reason I ask this is that he's coming up to 63 and approaching retirement and doesn't want to start a business or anything, but he does want to basically have some sort of hobby that his time is being covered by selling the things that he makes.
It's a well-worn path. People who start a little hobby business and you know, as a sideline. I think if anybody is making things as a hobby and maybe selling them for cash at a car boot sale, I don't think anybody's going to be any the wiser, and I'm sure the tax man is not going to be particularly concerned about that. But if you are doing things like Etsy or selling through Facebook, or was it YouMonday? Never heard of that one. Do you know that one?
YouMonday, I've never heard of it, no.
No, okay, well, have a look at that, see what it is. If there's any kind of formal sort of paper trail or digital trail to that, then you've got to start keeping records, because at some point the tax man may get interested in it. I think there's I know the laws changed fairly recently, didn't they? About, is it a self-starter allowance or something it's called?
The crux of all this is there is no amount of money that you're allowed to earn tax-free, basically. You know, you can obviously, if you've got personal things and you just flog them on eBay or whatever, that's not a thing, because you're probably selling them less than what you bought them for anyway, and you're certainly not doing it as a business. But if you are purposely making things to sell, that is a business. You know, you there is no such thing as or in the past there has never been such a thing as being able to make things and sell them and not declare them. If you're not declaring them, that is tax evasion, simple as that. But the government brought in a new thing a couple of years ago known as a trading allowance. And the trading allowance is £1,000 of turnover, and it's £1,000 of turnover, not profit. So you do have to bear that in mind. Normally, for tax calculations and everything like that, you're talking about profit. For your personal allowance, you're talking about profit, which at the minute you can make up to £12,500 before you have to start paying tax, income tax. But it doesn't mean that you get away with not having to register as a business. And the rules are, if you're making over £1,000 a year turnover, then you need to register and you need to become either a sole trader or a limited company. At that kind of level, sole trader is the way to go. So it depends how much you're planning to make, really. And if you're going to be making less than £1,000 a year, and if there's a chance it's going to go past £1,000 a year, I would keep records anyway. It's just good practice, and you never know. HMRC might ask if you ever got audited. They might ask for records going back to day one, even before you were making £1,000 a year. So it's good practice just to keep accounting records right from the start. You're certainly not going to be able to offset losses or anything like that against tax if you're not registered. That's another thing. So
yeah,
and that might work in your favour anyway. So there's all sorts of things that you need to take into consideration, but there is no such thing as a shortcut to not setting up as a business if you are trying to be a business. And if you are making things to put them on Etsy or anything else to make money, you are a business. There's no getting away from it. But you do have that trading allowance kind of comfort blanket there to help you get by before you need to start pestering HMRC with tax returns, basically.
Yeah, it's not a lot of £1,000, is it?
It's not. It can disappear very quickly. And sometimes you can be better off registering and then offsetting losses and things like that. So you need to speak to an accountant, really. Don't take anything I'm saying as tax advice. Please do speak to an accountant. But
yeah,
sometimes you can be better off registering as a business because you might have more than £1,000 in costs, in which case you could now be making a loss that you could potentially offset against other tax that you've paid. Say, for example, you've paid tax through investments or savings and stuff, you might be able to claim some tax back. So it might actually work in your favour to register as a business anyway. You need to speak to an accountant or someone who understands your finances in detail. Yeah,
financial advisor or an accountant. And certainly most accountants, I think, would give you an hour of their time or half an hour or 20 minutes as an initial consultation if they think it's going to be worth their while further down the line. If they'd give you that time gratis, and I certainly know my guys will do that, and I know a few others who would do that as well. The initial consult to see if they can help you or not is usually free, yeah, so it wouldn't cost you anything.
They want to sign you up as a long-term
exactly
customer, and they do that by, you know, just having a quick chat at the beginning. Sometimes that'll be enough for them to just say, look, don't worry about it, keep your turnover below £1,000 a year, and then you can just kind of forget about it. But we'll include, and there's accountancy forums and business forums out there as well that you can post questions like that to in a bit more detail if you wanted to do that. We'll include a couple of links in the description to a bit. I've made a video about the whole trading allowance thing. We'll include a link to that, and we'll include a link to the government's website that describes the trading allowance, because there's also a trading allowance for property as well. There's £1,000 property income and there's £1,000 business income allowance. And this is totally separate to your personal allowance and all of that. It effectively means, actually, if you're employed, it kind of means that your £1,000 or your tax allowance has kind of gone up by £1,000, kind of, but only if you're employed. If you're self-employed, it's all assessed based on your normal £12,500 tax allowance that you get in the UK at the moment. But that changes from year to year. So if you're listening to this in future time, all of that will have changed.
And if Steve says he's going to be planning on doing this as a retirement project, so obviously if he's retired, I presume he'll be having a pension. Obviously his pension would be taxed. So pay income tax on your pension. So would he be allowed to offset losses?
Potentially.
From?
Yeah.
Potentially,
you see, yeah. This is where it gets...
That's where you need advice from an accountant, really.
Yeah.
Then you get into tax codes and...
In a nutshell, there's two ways of doing your accounts when you're self-employed. In the UK, you can either do cash basis, providing your turnover's below, I think, £150,000 a year. So probably most smaller businesses will probably go down the cash basis route because it basically keeps things really simple. Or you can go down the traditional accounting route, accruals-based accounting. Generally, if you're doing that, you're probably going to have an accountant involved unless you understand accounting practices in detail. If you're on cash basis, you can't offset losses. You don't get a thing known as sideways loss relief.
Mm.
And sideways loss relief allows you to offset the loss from one portion of income against the loss or the profits of another portion of income. Again, speak to an accountant. It's a complex subject.
Yeah, so speak to somebody who isn't us, basically.
Yeah. It's one of those things where you need someone to have an in-depth understanding of your accounts to make that kind of decision.
Yes.
Because you would probably have to go down the accruals accounting route, which means you're going to have accountancy fees, etc., etc. Are they going to cost you more than you would save in the tax that you're going to have to pay if you don't offset the loss, basically? There you go, in a nutshell.
So selling for cash at a car boot sale sounds like a good option to me personally, but not that we would ever suggest such a thing.
And the thing is as well, if you are going down the Etsy or U Monday or anything like that, you're creating a paper trail. So, you know, you're making it very easy for HMRC if you did start to make a more serious, and, you know, let's be realistic here, HMRC tend not to audit very small businesses because it costs them more.
Because it's not worth their
time. To make back for it. Yeah, exactly. They have much bigger fish to fry. It doesn't mean it doesn't happen, but generally speaking, if you're making, you know, £5,000 a year or something, they're probably going to not care. Probably. But that's you're not off the hook. They could certainly come down on you like a ton of bricks and put do you for tax evasion if it's blatant. But at the end of the day, you know, if you're doing it through these channels that you're talking about, you're creating a very easy paper trail for HMRC to follow.
Yeah.
Some of these companies have to report directly to HMRC to tell them about people who are registered through those companies. Yeah. So, anyway.
It's not the sort of thing you can duck out of, unfortunately.
Yes.
What
else have we had? We got a really good message from Tom as well. We thought we'd put the time serve thing to bed. You've raised it again. So Tom says, I thought I'd share with you where the time served label has come from. Hopefully this will close the long debate. And Tom says he's a 29-year-old cabinet maker based in Snowdonia. So Tom said, traditionally, pre-1960, young carpenters and joiners and cabinet makers would complete a 5-year apprenticeship under a master craftsman. Well, that's already different to what my father-in-law did on his apprenticeship, which was 4 years, I think. I've done a video about that, but okay, fair enough. On completion of their apprenticeship, they would then serve their time after the apprenticeship. This would involve a continuation of work for the craftsman that mentored them, usually for 2 to 5 years, to give back the time that the mentor gave up during the young person's apprenticeship. So generally, a time-served craftsman is a person who has spent 7 to 10 years working under and alongside a master craftsman. Someone who is not time-served would complete the apprenticeship, leave their mentor, and work for someone else or go out on their own, and as in what Tom does. A typical millennial, he says. I have, however, spent the last 13 years making bespoke joinery and furniture. Anyway, I hope this clears things up. I'm sure Paul Sellers has spoken about this before too. I'm not sure. I haven't seen Paul Sellers' video about this, but if anyone has a link to it, then please do send us it. It would be interesting. Again, great topics that you've mentioned there, Tom, but it is different to everything that we've been told, unfortunately.
Yes, this is part of the problem, isn't it? There's so many versions of the same reality going on.
You're the first person to say, Tom, that you need to be doing 7 to 10 years before you're considered time served.
Yeah, also, the phrase master craftsman, I didn't think that was actually a thing here in the UK.
Yeah, but does that mean because that's not a thing?
Do we have master
craftsmen? I'm not sure. I think there are organisations who you can register through and declare yourself as a master craftsman, but I don't know that much about that to talk about it. But does that mean if the master craftsman doesn't really exist now, does that mean it's impossible to become time served?
So many questions, as always. More questions than answers. Good little piece there, though, Tom. Thanks for getting in touch with that one.
Thanks for clearing that up. But in all seriousness, and the thing is as well, you know, is it different in Wales? Maybe that's another...
Maybe it's... true. Tom's in Snowdonia, isn't he? So, yes.
Yeah. So maybe it's another different way things are done. I've just heard so many different ways from people saying they've done 1 or 2 year apprenticeships who declare themselves as time served, through to people saying they've done 4 or 5 years and saying they're time served. I think what you're saying is correct, probably traditionally. 7 to 10 years does sound, that makes a lot more sense. What Tom's saying makes more sense, because then I could never understand how you could just do an apprenticeship and then consider yourself as time served. But what Tom's saying is you do the apprenticeship and then you...
And then you serve that time back.
You serve your time afterwards. And that makes a lot more sense. It's just we've had a lot of comments from other people saying that that's not the case. Oh. So you've opened a can of worms again, Tom.
We need to slam that lid back on fairly firmly, don't we? What are we talking about? Oh, thank you, everybody, for all the feedback. That's fantastic. Don't forget, you can send us feedback to contact@measuringuppodcast.com. or through the contact form at measuringuppodcast.com, or of course through the social media places, Twitter at measuringuppc on the Twitter, and through Instagram at measuringuppodcast on Instagram. All good ways to getting in touch with us. Thank you to everybody who's done that. Potential topics for the show, Andy. We're recording this on Black Friday. Does that mean that the show will be 30% less, or does that mean the show will be 70% less? I'm always confused about percentages. Yeah, so special Black Friday edition.
So today is Black Friday. I had no idea. I'm so detached from...
Apparently so. Last Friday of November.
Wow. Well, I'm just going to stay indoors just in case.
Yeah, absolutely. It seems, I mean, Black Friday is a sort of an American import by and large. I don't think anybody in Britain knew about Black Friday or was aware of it until it became a thing. And for the last few weeks, we seem to have had pre-Black Friday sales going on from every Tom, Dick and Harry, I was going to say a tool company, but just everybody who manages to spam my email folders. I've been getting Black Friday deals from just everybody. And do you ever take advantage of them?
No.
Does a 20% off spur you on to make a purchase?
I don't think I've ever bought anything through a Black Friday deal, and I'm sure there'll be people shouting at the speaker right now saying, oh, you could have saved yourself a fortune on whatever. It's just, I buy things when I need to buy things, and I certainly am not beholden to any random deals that come up, you know.
Yeah,
I think normally the stuff that drops in price that significantly anyway tends to be, in my experience, older stock that was probably, they're just looking to get shot of it, you know. Yeah. They're not going to sell it at a loss, are they?
No, of course not.
So, and plus, as you say, it seems to drag on for like the entire November and December now.
Yeah.
So, no, I haven't. What about you? Have you?
Occasionally, if I've got something in mind that I want to buy, typically I'm not a sales sort of person. If there's something I've got in mind that I want, I'll typically just get it. You know, if I need it, I'll buy it. If I'd like it, then maybe I'll see if there's a special offer price coming around. And if it does happen to be around the end of November, then maybe I'll wait and see. But a lot of the special deals seem to be, as you say, either on older stock, so it's not necessarily what you want, or just, you know, not that great. I mean, maybe it's a small saving, maybe it isn't. And I'd rather just buy something when I need it rather than hanging on just for a special sale price. Same with Christmas sales or January sales or anything else. You know, I always think, well, if you want it, just buy it. If you've got time to wait to see if it's on a special offer in any of those other times, then by all means, then wait and see. But if you need it, then typically you need it now rather than in a month's time or whatever. So just buy it.
Exactly.
Yeah, I'm never really a particular fan.
Exactly. And apparently,
Maker Central back is indeed back. I've been telling people on Instagram and on Twitter all week that yes, we'll be there. You hadn't even realised it.
I had no clue. I had literally no clue. I mean, I've been curbing back on Instagram a little bit because
yes.
Every time I go on, I'm just seeing more and more. And it's not just my content that's been stolen and posted around, but I'm seeing so many other channels where their content, which is way better than my content, by the way. the only thing I've really had getting stolen is that gate hinge video, and it you know, whatever.
Yeah.
But when you're seeing some of the stuff that's in on these channels, you know, beautiful, like, works of art of woodworking projects and things, and amazingly shot videos that have just all been stolen, and they're now being used to promote all these scam multi-level marketing companies.
Yeah.
And it really annoys me that they're using my content to promote their product. And I find one of the easy ways to not being annoyed by that is just to not look at it. Been posting less content, and I'm using Instagram less and less. The problem with Instagram is that they don't have a facility like Twitter to share someone else's post.
Mm.
So as a result, the only way to share someone else's post is to use things such as repost. And repost might as well be called copy someone else's post and just randomly post it without permission, because copying someone's post and putting a credit on it does not mean it's all right to copy that person's post. No. You know, copyright laws are pretty straightforward. You don't copy anything without that person's permission. Yeah. You don't know anything about the background of certain images and things like that on Instagram. And if you're going to take something in its entirety and then copy it and put it on your own profile and then try and make money off the back of it, which is what these MLM companies are doing, I mean, it's 100% illegal. Anyway, but slightly off on a tangent there. Mega Central, sorry.
Yeah, Mega Central. So it's back. Early May 2020. So are we going to be there? We probably ought to have a chat about this off air, shouldn't we?
Yeah, I honestly don't know at the minute, because my head was in... The last I heard was that it definitely wasn't going to be on next year. And then I heard a rumour that it was going to be on in London. Mm-hmm. And then I heard another rumour that that was just a rumour. So I went back to the default position of it definitely not being on. And then suddenly I've heard that it is on.
Well, the announcement has been made. It is official. The website is up and running. May 2nd and 3rd, 2020, is on in Birmingham, as usual.
So I need to see what's happening next year. I honestly don't know at this stage. So I need to have a look into calendars and all of that, because we've got a whole load of stuff happening next year that it might end up clashing with. But we shall see. Watch this space. Finning, are you definitely going? Or
I'll definitely be there, yeah. The only question is whether or not we get a stand there for the podcast or whatever.
Well, as I say, I'll look into what's happening, and I shall let you know. But failing that, you can go as 10-minute workshop.
Absolutely, and yeah, good stuff. All right, last week we talked about the Morris commercial e-van, and this week, obviously, Elon Musk, shaking in his boots, has launched the Tesla Cybertruck. These two are like chalk and cheese in terms of electric vehicles, aren't they? It's just unreal.
I still can't entirely get my head around whether or not this is a real thing. Is it? It's not a hoax, is it? This is a genuine...
Oh, he's taking orders for it, let's put it that way.
Yeah, and I'd heard he'd taken like some crazy, like half a million back orders or something like that.
Something crazy, yeah. 160,000 orders in the first day or something.
Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, it looks amazing. It does.
I think it looks hideous.
Well, it just looks like something out of Blade Runner. You know, it is absolutely, in terms of upsetting the market.
Oh, absolutely. Just,
but I don't know anything about... I don't know how... I mean, presumably the whole idea is that it's an ultra-utilitarian vehicle that doesn't care about how it looks, and this is what the future is going to be,
and it's electric, and it's massive,
and it doesn't matter that it's massive, even though it probably won't fit into any parking space in the UK, but it doesn't matter because it's electric. Yeah. And
it's a Cybertruck, which means like a pickup truck, so, you know, of limited appeal and interest here, although it does have a built-in cover for the bed, although it slopes down, so...
Could you fit a fridge in the back of it?
I don't know.
So
can you fit a fridge in the back of yours?
In the back of my truck? Yeah, it's perfect size for like a...
Can you fit a meter square cube for a Lego display in the back?
As long as you've got like a normal kind of dishwashery size. You know, I'm thinking of your situation where you need to go and buy a new washing machine or something like that, and you nip.
They get delivered generally.
Yeah, okay, well, whatever. But you need to take your old one to the tip because the delivery companies refuse to take it away or something. Anyway.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't buy from them. Anyway, yeah.
My point is, if you own a truck like that, you would hope that you would be able to get a fridge in the back.
You would hope, yeah.
And to me, if you couldn't, I haven't even seen what the... Have you seen what the storage is like in it?
No, I don't think anybody has. It's all I've seen is what's been posted online, and I think Marcus Brownlee has had a closer look at one. So maybe we'll head over to Marcus Brownlee's channel and have a look.
I saw a couple of videos about it, and most of them were showing kind of CGI impressions of the interior and things like that. And it's like, is this a... I mean, I know obviously it's a prototype, but is this really going to get made? Is it a... That's what
who could doubt Elon Musk? You know, he's there, he said it's happening, and he's taking orders.
Well,
good luck to him.
If anyone's buying a Cybertruck, or if anyone in the future has bought a Cybertruck, then do let us know, because it's talk about turning the market upside down.
Yeah, well, they do that. I don't know if you've seen it, but they have that classic tug of war between the Ford F-150 is the one of the most popular vehicles in the US. It's a big Ford pickup, and they have the classic sort of tug of war between that and the Cybertruck, and the Cybertruck just sort of pulls the Ford 150 away with the Ford's wheels spinning wildly. Yeah,
I saw that. And
everybody's complaining. They're saying, that Ford's only two-wheel drive. You should have had it in four-wheel drive. It should have been fully laden instead of unladen.
I was going to say that. When I saw the video, it was like, well, it's only the back wheels that are wheel spinning, and you're against a Cybertruck that is presumably in four-wheel drive. So is that a...
Almost certainly, yeah.
Was it a free, a fair test? I don't know. Anyway, it looks interesting. It does look interesting. But
interesting. Interesting, definitely.
Well, is the world ready for Blade Runner-type Cybertrucks yet?
I don't know. Was the world ready for Teslas? They're here. I see plenty of them around, so clearly they're...
I mean, the thing with the Cybertruck as well, it seemed cheap from what I saw, unless there was a mistake on the price, but it was like $30,000 or something, wasn't it?
$43,000, I think, was the...
Yeah, so what's that, 35 grand or 30, like 35 that, grand? Which, considering the cheapest Tesla is, what, 60 or 70 grand? Or
something like that.
For a big commercial vehicle, potentially, as I say, providing you can actually fit stuff in the back, big enough to store a meter square cube unit.
My nephew has a Tesla, and one of the things they will do is mobile servicing, because there's not much to do to them. So he was parked at my sister's house, and the Tesla service guy comes up in another Tesla, and all the tools just slide out of a rack in the back of the Tesla boot.
Really?
The Tesla hatch is really so cool, like
Tesla service vehicles that are Teslas, basically.
Yeah, it's just a Tesla Model S with...
Oh, wow.
Fancy bits in the back.
I really want an electric car. I really want an electric car. As I say, we've both vehicles are due for a change, and we had a look into the whole Ioniq thing, which was thoroughly miserable experience.
Yeah, less than stellar.
But it's so frustrating. I am ready to buy an electric car, but I just feel like the choice out there and the infrastructure is just not in place to make it a viable option yet.
I posted a little snippet. We've been out last week, and we were coming back sort of late-ish, and I think I mentioned we've got lamppost chargers in our street. There were two. They've been converting lampposts to LEDs, which effectively gives them spare capacity in the lamppost network. And what some clever firm has decided, a company called Ubitricity, is that they can use that spare capacity to actually offer in lamppost chargers. Now, I've got one opposite my street, opposite my house, and there's one at the other end of the road. We've never seen anybody use them. And as we were coming back from being out last week, the one at the other end of the road is being used. So there was a Volvo, I think, presumably a plug-in hybrid, that had a cable snaking out of the fuel cap into the side of the lamppost, and just sort of quietly charging.
How does it charge you? How do you pay for the electrics? Has it got?
Well, this is the little gotcha that I put in. I think it was an Instagram post, so you probably wouldn't have seen it. Excuse me. Ubitricity, you buy the cable from them, and the cable, it's a smart cable, obviously, and that's your cable, and wherever you plug that into, you are then billed for the electric that you use. How much would you pay for a smart cable to charge your vehicle?
For the cable?
Bearing in mind this is the equivalent of paying to get into a petrol station. How much would you pay for that?
So to physically own this cable, just so this is to buy a cable. So basically you're paying for a fancy extension cable.
To physically own the cable, yeah.
20 quid, 30 quid maybe?
Try 400.
You are joking me. 400 quid?
400 notes for the smart cable.
But you see, this is where the whole thing just falls down, because you're never going to save that.
Ah, but you can charge it in the lamppost that isn't outside your house. Oh, hang on. And provided nobody else is parked there.
And then do you pay for the electricity on top of that?
Oh, yes, you pay for the electric on top of that. You pay, again, two options. You can pay a monthly 8 quid, roughly, and get the electric slightly cheaper. I'd need to double-check the figures. I think it's 14 pence per kilowatt hour, might be slightly more. Or you can have no monthly fee and pay 19 pence per kilowatt hour.
You see, this is where the whole, everything, it just all falls down. And then suddenly it's like, well, no, I'm not buying one. Not until all this mess gets sorted out. I'm not paying £400 on a cable. What absolute gaga land are people living in with this? It's because you would never save that on fuel.
I put on Twitter that Instagram, that's more, that 400 quid is more than I spend on diesel in a year.
400 in a year?
Yeah. I don't do many miles.
Really? You only spend £400 a year on diesel?
Yeah. I fill up six times.
Wow.
I do less than 1,000 miles a year.
Right. Yeah. Wow.
Which is what is really, really annoying me about this whole thing where I'm going to have to get rid of the van. You know, it's just,
But there you go. There you go. That absolutely sums it up.
Anyway, there you go. Yeah. 400 notes. Funnily enough, we were out last night. My dad came to London with my sister and her husband and his mum. It was my dad's birthday while we were away in Venice. He was 94. Happy birthday, Dad.
Happy birthday, Peter's dad.
And normally, thank you. Yeah, his name's Derek. Normally, we have a bit of a family gathering around the time of his birthday, just because it's a convenient sort of point to hang it on. But he didn't want the fuss or bother this year, but he was persuaded to come to London for the day. So they came down on the train, because it's only a two-hour journey from Cheshire down to London on the train. So we came out to London for the day. It wasn't the best of days, unfortunately. Would have been a nicer day today because it's absolutely beautiful and bright and sunny. But they came down. We had a nice leisurely lunch. And then Linda was going off to, my wife Linda was going off to meet a friend. So I was coming back home on my own a little bit later on. And blow me, there was, as I was coming around, walking around one of the side streets, there was a cable protector, you know, one of those little sort of wedge things over a cable. Blow me, somebody in the rain, I don't know how safe it is, but somebody must be safe, I guess. Somebody was charging their car from in a terraced house, there's no driveways or anything. So they had a cable snaking out of a window on the ground floor into some sort of extension box through this cable, under this cable protector, plugged in at the curb. So, yes, there you go. There's 400 quid saved by not having a smart cable.
But the thing is with all of this, so you're going to have to be before you stand a chance of being better off as a result of owning and I know it's not just about being better off, but, you know, there's got to be some financial incentive to owning an electric car. They're already way more expensive than petrol vehicles and whatnot. So it's got to be cheaper to run. If it's not cheaper to run, game over, you know. So to save that kind of money, you're going to have to be doing a lot of miles. And you can't do a lot of miles because they don't do a lot of miles, because the range isn't there. So until they sort out the range problems, you're never going to be able to do the miles to get back what you've invested in owning one of these.
They make perfect sense for somebody who's commuting 30 to 40 miles a day.
Yeah.
If you've got a 30 to 40 mile commute there and back in a day, charge at night on economy 7 equivalent electric, costs you next to nothing, and your quid's in. For somebody like me who's doing super low mileage, even though the mileage I do, it's the perfect environment for an electric vehicle in a city, it's never, ever, ever going to make sense.
Yeah.
It'll just never make sense.
I did see a very interesting video about a new battery technology. I saw that too,
yeah.
Oh, what's it called? It's dropped out my brain.
Yeah, I've forgotten as well, but I saw the vid.
Solid state battery technology or something like that it's called, I think. And they reckon that that'll double to triple the range of electric vehicles if this, but they don't, I mean, it's very, very early days, proof of concept time, but it's a radical departure in battery technology since lithium ion was invented, which that is the current model that's used for batteries and has been for the last, 20 years or something? I don't know.
Yes.
And this would be the next big revolution in battery technology. And if that comes in, that has the potential of, apparently it recharges way, way quicker. The lifespan of the batteries is much higher. The range and it would be, as I say, 2 to 3 times for electric vehicles. I'll include a link in the description to that video. It's quite an interesting one. But I think until we get a jump like that in the technology, I just don't think we're there yet, unfortunately, as much as I would love one.
I think a lot depends on the sort of driving that you do and your needs. And again, it's a bit like you can't treat an electric vehicle like a petrol vehicle, even though that's what you're used to and that's what you want. The idea of just jumping in your car and doing 300 miles without stopping is strictly into the realm of Teslas right now, because they're the only electric vehicles that can do that, because they charge very quickly.
Yeah,
and they have honking great batteries, which makes them heavy cars. However, they are the only electric vehicles, as far as I know, that will do that sort of mileage to a single charge. Everybody else is struggling along to get over 100 miles there. There's a Renault Zoe, I think, which has a couple hundred miles to a charge. I think that's the sort of table stakes now. You know, for any electric car, they need to be doing sort of a couple of 150 to a couple of 100 miles to a charge.
But it means that, for example, if I wanted to drive down to London, I couldn't do it.
No, not without stopping and charging.
Not without a stop. And presumably quite a significant stop I would need. I don't know, 2-3 hour minimum, I would have thought.
Yes, I would think so.
And that's if you can find a charging point.
Well, they seem to be, again, there seem to be lots of electric charge points around, but of course, as more people get electric vehicles, then they become busier.
Exactly.
So are there enough?
So you plan your journey.
Plus, they're quite expensive. Sorry to interrupt. They're quite expensive, the rapid chargers that are on in motorway service centres and those sort of things. They're not cheap.
And you plan your journey around, okay, I'll stop at that particular one, and you get there and they're all full. What do you do?
Yeah.
So, yeah, anyway. On that note, we're out of time for this week, but we've got lots of interesting things to chat about next week. And remember, it's a Patreon-only show next week. If you want the weekly show, all you need to do is go to patreon.com/measuringuppodcast and sign up there, and you can get the weekly show. Failing that, if you don't want to do that, you can stick with the free 2 weekly show that we're doing at the minute. But we've got a lot of interesting stuff to chat about next week. I think it would be good to continue the theme of accounts and all that, because it is that time of year and a bit of businessy stuff on next week's one.
Incidentally, just before we sort of duck into the next section, you said at the end of the last show, I think, that you were really enjoying that you hoped everybody was enjoying the new format. Are you enjoying it, just out of interest?
Yeah, I think it's awesome.
Doing a weekly show?
Yeah,
me too. I'm loving it. I absolutely really, really, really enjoy having two sort of hour-longish shows rather than a show and a after show. I'm really loving this. It's great.
It's great. I mean, it is a lot of extra editing work, so we'll see where things go. As long as we can keep the support growing on Patreon, I would say, you know, we do need more people to be supporting on Patreon for the weekly thing to be worthwhile. I love doing it, and I think it works really well, and I think it rewards our loyal Patreon supporters who are helping to keep the lights on the show.
We certainly are. We want to thank some of those. In fact, we want to thank all of our loyal Patreon supporters for their continuing support, which really does help us keep going. But in particular, I'd like to thank Tim. We'd like to thank the Untested Woodworker, Mike Broom, Greg Humphreys, Jamie Fraser, James Ian Wilson, Harry Kappa, James's Man Cave, Brendan from the Shades Workshop, and Paul at Cunningham's Custom Creations.
And I'm going to give a big shout out to Michael Stringer, David Chisnell, Keith Turner, Wilson Chan, Pascal from MK Creations, Andrew Cartledge, James Hewitt, John Fogarty, Jonathan Holford, and Randall Davis.
Yeah, thank you very much indeed. Don't forget, if you have the time and the energy, give us a rating or a review on iTunes. iTunes, of course, is the main directory where people get their podcasts from. So if you can spare us the time, then we've got over 250 five-star reviews and ratings on iTunes there. If you can spare the time, we'd really appreciate it. If you can go and give us another rating on there, that'd be fantastic. Thank you very much indeed. You can support the show and get extra weekly episodes at patreon.com/measuringup podcast. You can follow both of us at Andy. Where can people find you?
You can find me, Gosforth Handyman, on YouTube, Gosforth Andy on Twitter. And if you do want to do the Instagram thing, it's Gosforth Handyman on Instagram as well. And where do we find you, Peter?
I am at 10 Minute Workshop on Instagram, at 10 Minute Shop on Twitter, and 10 Minute Workshop on YouTube. That's it, though, for this week. I think if you want to get in touch with us, obviously, contact form on measuringuppodcast.com is the best way to do it, or you can email the show at contact@measuringuppodcast.com, which will always reach us. But I think that's it for this week. Thank you very much indeed for your attention so far, and we'll see you in the next one.
See you next time.
Bye.